As a child, Otha Ellis Bates McDaniel taught himself to play guitar, but he never found one he liked, so he built his own. Soon after, his rectangular-shaped axe with an old TV dial for a volume knob could be heard on radios everywhere as he launched the beat heard round the world. He was Bo Diddley. His handmade guitar is at the Hard Rock Cafe in Times Square. Thousands of other priceless pieces of rock history are at Hard Rock Cafes, casinos, and hotels around the world. To learn more, visit hardrock.com.
Little Steven's Underground Garage's coolest conversations, presented by Hard Rock Cafe, hosted by the Mighty Manfred.
This is the Mighty Manfred with you in Little Steven's Underground Garage, and it's time for another Coolest Conversations throwback. Thanks for listening, and remember to follow and subscribe, rate, and review. Today's interview takes us back to July the 31st, 2015, when I spoke with Berence Whitfield of Berence Whitfield and the Savages. The band formed in Boston back in the early 80s, later disbanding. We talk about their reforming. Also about those early days, we mention how their popularity in the UK was spearheaded by disc jockeys like John Peel and Andy Kershaw. Also, we talk about their touring with the Sonics, which was in support of their new album at the time, Under the Savage Sky. That features their coolest song of the week called I'm a Full-Grown Man. Let's hear some of that now, and that'll be followed by my interview with Berence on your Coolest Conversations, presented by Hard Rock in Little Steven's Underground Garage. This is the Mighty Manfred, and it is time to have our coolest conversations for the day. And joining me is Berence Whitfield, lead vocalist and front man for Berence Whitfield and the Savages. Hello, Berence. How are you?
Oh, Mighty Manfred, I'm fine. Good to hear you on the radio.
Oh, man. Thanks for speaking with me today, my man.
It's always a pleasure.
So we just took a listen to I'm a Full-Grown Man. That's the coolest song in the world this week from the brand new album Under the Savage Sky, which is due out later on this month, the 21st of August. And I know that song is a Timmy Willis song titled I'm a Man. Why did you change the title?
Well, we had this, Peter had this idea of, we had this vision of, because we're all in our older ages, and we're all full grown men. We've pretty much done a lot of stuff that all full grown men do in their lives. So, and we've been through that situation a few times, as the song dictates. So we just figured, well, let's, instead of being a man, let's be full grown men.
Oh, I hear you, my man. So, thinking about that song, in its original version, more of a soul thing, but that guitar riff is so heavy, kind of unusual for an R&B thing at the time. Something like Vanilla Fudge, they just needed to look a little deeper for stuff like that. So whose record collection gets rated for the covers, and how do you guys go about writing original songs?
Well, it comes pretty much out of Peter's wide selection of records. He's got a nice, really good collection of soul, R&Bs, recently beginning into jazz a lot. He's been listening to a lot of jazz. Of course, I've been doing that for years. But he has a big 45 collection, so he's always playing me oddball 45s. And then he's been getting into the songwriting thing with a gentleman that lives in the same city he lives in Albuquerque, named Mike Mooney, who wrote, you know, the last two records that we've done, a few of his songs are on the record, like the Coroner Man and Willie Meehan and Incarcerated Casserole, which is on the new album. So yeah, Peter's been writing all the music, and then Phil has written always comes up with some cool tunes. Of course, he was the originator of Bloody Mary, which is probably one of the greatest Savage songs of all time, I would have to say.
Since the beginning, I'd say you guys haven't covered as much as uncovered great R&B, early raw R&B, rock and roll, occasionally soul tunes as well. And that lineup then, back then, the very beginning, featured Peter Greenberg on guitar and Phil Lenker on bass. You've just mentioned both those guys. And each of those guys also were in the Liars with Jeff Connelly early on. Tell me, how did Berence Whitfield and the Savages form? And why, after the first couple of albums, did those guys go on and do something else?
Well, we got together. Peter had just left the Liars, after being with Jeff for so many years. And he had this vision that he wanted to put together a kind of a garagey R&B, jump blues kind of band. But he wanted to have an African-American singer who... In the vein of Little Richard and Escarita, who could scream his guts out. So, you know, he was looking, and a friend of mine who we worked at this record shop called Nuggets in Boston. We both got fired from the same record store at different times, and a friend of mine who knew Peter introduced me to him. I said, "Hey, listen," because he heard me singing in the store. I used to live in New Jersey, around the Northeast Orange area. I grew up down there. And I went to school in Boston at BU. But he was looking for somebody like that, and this friend of his heard me sing in the store, and he said, "Hey, man, you got a good voice. A friend of mine's looking for a singer. You should hang out with him." So I met Peter at the record store, and then we went back to his house, and he started pulling out all sorts of weird tunes I'd never heard. Like, the first tune he played was a tune called "Mama Get the Hammer, Flies on the Baby's Head." And I said, "Uh-oh, what do we got here?" Listening to all this great stuff. So I was really intrigued. So I didn't even have to utter a note. He figured, this is my man. This is who I'm going to, you know, who we're going to be. So Phil had played with the Liars. And then we got Howie Ferguson, who played with the Real Kids and the Liars. And we got him on drums. And then we got Steve LaGrega, who was another ex-Nuggets employee. And that's how the Savages started. And then we worked together for about 3 years, and then Peter just felt he'd played enough music, and he wanted to, you know, get married and have a family and work and, you know, do the all-American thing to do. Phil the same. He kept playing a little bit. But, and then after that, the Savages actually evolved into another version of the Savages, and that's where the "Ow, Ow, Ow" and the "Dust on My Needle" come through. But those first 3 years were really exciting.
And so what possessed Peter and Phil to get back in touch with you to sort of jumpstart things over again?
Well, that happened due to the fact that we got our first album was getting reissued by Ace Records in London. Great, great label. And I got on the phone with Peter, and we were talking. The first time I talked to him, we had not talked to each other. Well, Phil I talked to now and then, but me and Peter, we hadn't really talked to each other in 26 years. So at that time, about 5 years ago, so we just, he had something going on with Mike Mooney, a band called Mamby's Head in Albuquerque. And I said, "Man, if you want me to come out and do some songs with you, I'd love to fly out and play with you again." 2 weeks later, "Hey, Berence, I just booked up some shows. I've called Phil. Let's fly. You fly out and we'll talk. We'll get together." So as we were staying at his house, we were sitting around the breakfast table, and we were talking about, maybe we can do this again. There's no coincidence that we got back together again to talk to each other for something like this to happen again. So we just went with it. The feeling, knowing that we could probably pull it off again. And then we got two more guys to come along with us, Andy Jody, who's from Cincinnati, who played with Peter and some, you know, bands. You know, he did some stuff with him. And Tom Quartulli, who I actually hooked up with on a couple of shows and thought he might be the right guy, and just took it off, and you know, here we are, man. You know, doing our third record.
Well, so you mentioned there the first album getting reissued on Ace, the English label, and I know it was like years ago that BBC disc jockey Andy Kershaw kind of fell in love with you guys and was instrumental in bringing you to the UK for the first time, and you guys were pretty big there for a while, weren't you?
Oh, yeah. I mean, if it wasn't for Andy Kershaw, I would never have gone to Europe and be so successful in playing not only in England, but in Spain and France and Italy and Belgium and, you know, all around that area, Italy. So, I mean, yeah, he was a big champion along with another guy, John Peel. And they were champions of the band. And a lot of people in England had paced me up. They said, Barrence Whitfield's the next Little Richard.
So how did that thing with Kershaw come? How did that, did he have, he must have seen you somewhere, or he's heard the records?
Well,
and then
no, he actually had a friend of his who played with Billy Bragg, and we were very popular in the Washington, D.C. area, had a real huge cult following, so a friend of his says, oh, you've got to hear this record. So he played it, his name is David Woodhead, he played trumpet in his band, and so he played the record for Dave, and he went, wow, I know somebody that would love this record. So went back to England, put it in the hands of Andy Kershaw. And when Andy first heard it, he said his head popped off his head, went through the ceiling, and he said, it's one of the great rock and roll records of the 80s. So he actually saw a phone number on the back of the record, called my manager at the time, and said, hey, listen, this is one of the greatest albums. I'm playing it on my program. And at that time, he had a huge program on the BBC. And plus, he was also a television presenter on the Old Grey Whistle Test, which is a legendary television music show in England. So within the next 3 months, he just said, that's it. I'm flying over to Boston. I must meet the man, and I got to hear the band. So he came over, met us, heard us play, and then about 4 months later, he said, listen, I want to get you on the Old Grey Whistle Test. So and this is the time when Peter and Phil were still in the band, so he came over with a crew, filmed us at one of the local clubs in Boston, and filmed it, and it got shown in the UK. This was in 1985, December of 1985. It was shown in front of a huge audience in the UK. The next year, we were over in England. But by that time, Peter and Phil had left the band.
Oh, well, so you're playing out again, and I saw you just a month or two ago opening up for the Sonics here in Los Angeles. Tell me what it was like touring with those guys or playing shows with those guys.
It was one of the biggest thrills of my life, touring with the Sonics. I mean, those guys, you know, and people forget that these guys pretty much almost predate the Rolling Stones. So, I mean, playing with them was just a thrill, and they were so respectful and knowledgeable of us. They were real happy to have us on the tour. Every night when they went on, they found the time to mention who we are and how much fun they're having with us, and reminding the crowd that we're not just opening band, we're headliners, and it was just great. I mean, we became bosom buddies after this, and every night we'd play in front of crowds, and it was just unbelievable. And you know, you had your Savages fans, you had your Sonics fans, and people that ever wanted to see us got a chance to see us, people that saw the Sonics, you know, so it was a win-win situation for both bands.
Well, let me ask you, So those guys were from Tacoma, and they were there in the early 60s going to see shows. And I know that a lot of R&B groups from that era were all playing through there. A lot of times they play, you know, the same club that the Spanish Castle there between Tacoma and Seattle, like Ike and Tina Turner's Revue would go through there. Did they have any stories about seeing any of those artists when they came through the area?
Not much. I mean, you know, it was really funny. We talked a few stories about, you know, certain shows, or because I don't think they really got that much outside of, you know, where they were from, the Northwest there, and maybe down in California or Phoenix. So, I mean, they mentioned a few acts. They mentioned the Wailers. They mentioned this guy named Dave Lewis, who was an organist out of Seattle. You know, they mentioned a few Paul Revere and the Raiders and stuff like that. But most of the time, we were just hanging out, like, you know, like when you hang out with your friends, you just talk about records and music and techniques and influences. Like, a lot of them were influenced by the Jerry Lee Lewis's, the Little Richards, the, you know, Elvis's and stuff like that, you know, rock and roll. So, I mean, that was their pride and joy. So that was pretty much what we were talking about. We just hung out and just had a good time, man. It was just like, you know, just like being out with your friends.
So we got more good times down the road, I'm hoping, because you guys did this tour with the Sonics, and the record wasn't, I don't know if they even, you guys had a release date yet for the album, but so it's going to be out the 21st of August, and right. Looking towards the fall, any more, any shows upcoming through the fall, or any tours happening, or what's the plan?
We do, as a matter of fact, we'll be, first of all, we'll start off in Toronto, we'll be in Canada for four shows, and then we're playing, like, you know, Indianapolis, Chicago, Detroit, Washington, D.C., Cleveland, Cincinnati, Chicago, places like that. So we're going to be around, you know, we're doing, I think, almost 3 weeks, starting the middle of August to middle of September. And then in October, we're definitely going to Europe. So far I've heard England and Scotland, and I think we're maybe going over to Finland and Denmark and France. So, I mean, a lot of stuff coming up for us, you know, and with the new record, promoting the new album, it's going to be fun being out on the road again. And I think the momentum will still be there from playing with the Sonics at a lot of these places, because I'm telling you, you know, once the word got out that we were playing with the Sonics, I mean, I looked up on social media and cities that we weren't even going into, how come not us? Why not us? You know, when are you going to come to, you know, when are you going to come to Atlanta? When are you going to come to D.C.? You know, I mean, that was one of the biggest shows in Boston. I mean, we sold out the local the venue that was here, and it was just unbelievable. And we saw faces that we hadn't seen in years. And we out in San Francisco, we played at the Fillmore, you know, Jello Biafra shows up, and Roy Loney from the Flamin' Groovies. It was unbelievable.
Let me ask you, who is, so you cover all, you know, a lot of this obscure stuff. Do you have a favorite, least known soul or R&B singer you think everybody should know about?
Oh, man, there's so many. There was this guy that we were really hip on for a little bit called Lee Moses out of Atlanta.
Oh, Bad Girl.
Yeah, Bad Girl, man, yeah. He was one of the guys. And I mean, there's so many people I could name. It'll take you. I'm almost destined to come on the show one of these days and have a record party. Just bring all the wild 45s and some LPs of stuff that I like, and just have a good time with you on the radio one of these
That
days.
Sounds good to me. We need to get that happening. Yeah. Well, let's listen to another track off of the upcoming album, the Under the Savage Sky. We'll go out with this one, but I want to talk about it first. I want us to play and listen to The Claw. Tell me about The Claw. What's The Claw all about?
Oh, I don't know. It's got some hidden innuendos in it. It's actually talking about somebody who, you know, who could actually explain it more is Phil, because he wrote the song, and he wrote it with some special person in mind, someone who loves to talk and go crazy, and so I don't know. He can more explain it than I can. That's how I got it, and I was like, oh, okay, and let's do it. And I like the riff on it, and you know, actually, I kept saying craw instead of claw. Do the craw, and they said, no, it's the claw, because I don't know if you remember the television show Get Smart.
Yes, of course.
There was an episode of there was this villain called the Claw, and he was Japanese, and you know how the Japanese have trouble pronouncing the letter L.
Yeah, an R.
It's R. So he keeps saying, oh, I got you now, Craw. He goes, no, not Craw, Claw. You know, so that's what kept me going like that with the claw. But it's a cool tune.
Well, we're going to lay the claw on the people in just a minute here. So first, though, Barents, thanks so much for talking with me today on our Coolest Conversations.
Well, thank you for having me on the show. I really dig it. You guys are definitely the seminal garage network or show in all the world, and I want you to continue to do what you do best. It's just racking them in and just putting them out.
Well, that's exactly what those are my marching orders, Barents, and I'll do my best to do that. So we're gonna leave now with that track off of Under the Savage Sky, the album due out August the 21st. Here's Barents, Whitfield and the Savages giving us the claw in Little Steven's Underground Garage.
The claw, stop right flapping your jaw. Do the claw, kill that metal straw. It's the claw. Your mom, as you sit, it should have been up before.
As a child, Otha Ellis Bates McDaniel taught himself to play guitar, but he never found one he liked, so he built his own. Soon after, his rectangular-shaped axe with an old TV dial for a volume knob could be heard on radios everywhere as he launched the beat heard round the world. He was Bo Diddley. His handmade guitar is at the Hard Rock Cafe in Times Square. Thousands of other priceless pieces of rock history are at Hard Rock Cafes, casinos, and hotels around the world. To learn more, visit hardrock.com.
Don't let it slide, baby, diamond ring.